Hey, folks, Damian Mason coming at you. Before we hop into another fantastic episode of The Business of Agriculture, I want to tell you about Pattern Ag. Pattern Ag is a company that has pioneered predictive soil analytics. You know, we always treated diseases and pests after they were already in the field, when they were already causing us a problem. But what if you can do this proactively through predictive soil analytics? Pattern has a technology that through their technology, you can say, oh, here's the likelihood that I'm going to have soybean cyst nematode. Here is the prediction on how bad of a risk I face for sudden death syndrome or corn rootworm and a whole bunch of other diseases and pests. When you know what your risk factor is, you can more efficiently and proactively treat for the disease. You can do this by going to pattern.ag and figuring out what your risk factors are through predictive analytics. That's right. Go to www.pattern.ag and then get a hold of your Pattern Ag representative to help you do predictive analytics on your farming operation. Well, greetings and welcome to another great episode of The Business of Agriculture. Today, we're talking about precision conservation. What? Precision conservation. Well, I know you've heard about precision agriculture. It's something we talk about a lot. But as technology advances, and more importantly, as the environmental push advances, is there a chance to bring together what we know about great crop production and maximizing production, but also maximizing conservation? I've got with me two people that are going to help us learn about this. Jacob Taylor with Pheasants Forever and Quail Unlimited. Quail Forever. And I've got Jeremy Fowler, who is a row crop producer in Tennessee. What we're talking about here is taking out productive ground that's maybe not that productive and putting it into a conservation role. In other words, you know that you have acres, depending on where you farm, that are not as productive as your good stuff. We introduced the CRP program about 35, 40 years ago, and this is maybe the next evolution of that. So that's what we're talking about today, precision conservation here at the Business of Agriculture. Jacob, you contacted me to talk about this, and I thought it was a great topic. Tell me real quickly your elevator speech. They always say that, which is funny, elevator speech. I don't like people talking to me in elevators. Actually, I don't like talking to people in public, period. But why the hell do I have to have people talk to me in the elevator? So anyway, don't give me your elevator speech. Just give me a couple minute lowdown on precision conservation. What's that mean? It says so in your byline, by the way, on your emails. Precision conservation. What is it?
So really, it's the strategic use of precision agriculture methods to pinpoint or prescribe conservation on areas in the field that are, for whatever reason, unproductive consistently every year, no matter how low the input prices, how high our commodity prices are each year, whether it be a couple acres, 3% of our farm, 10%, those acres that are constantly, consistently underproducing, we're looking at an alternate management option for those acres that might adjust the return on investment for the rest of the field, essentially turning red acres green.
Got it. I like it. So again, I opened up by saying that everybody knows they have some bad acres. You know, nobody wants to admit it, but we all have some bad acres. So the CRP program came about, what, 1986. I know you're a little younger than me, so this is ancient history for you, but it's not that ancient history for me. We invented the CRP program. Last article I read, I think we got about 30 or 32 million acres involved in the Conservation Reserve Program. I have about 16 acres in it myself. Because again, I took acres out that are lesser productive acres and I put them into the CRP with prairie grass and wetlands and some tree plantings because it was the right thing to do. And also I'm into the outdoors. How does this differ? What you're talking about? Is this the same thing? Do you tie into the CRP? What are you talking about doing? What is Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever doing? Does it accentuate? Does it tie into? Is it part of the same thing? What are we talking about?
So me specifically and a lot of other of our conservation delivery teams, we have agreements with the USDA where we work hand in hand with their county service centers to help them deliver their mission through programs. And CRP is one of our big programs, especially in what I'm doing. CRP is a great option on rented ground. And you probably know that. It's when we're talking about taking acres out of production and it's rented ground, we have to supplement that rent for the landowner with some sort of program. And CRP is that option. Here in the past couple of years, a lot of the language in CRP has changed. So it used to be where general CRP sign up, it would have to be whole fields. If you wanted to do a border around your field, it had to be the entire field. Now we can really prescribe CRP at a lot better level than what we used to. There's even a practice in CRP now that lets you use it as a turnaround, because a lot of the habitat we're putting on the ground needs disturbance, and that disturbance can be achieved from turning around on those borders. And so there's a lot more flexibility in the CRP program now that where we can prescribe it, like I said, with the precision agriculture data that we have. It's a lot more flexible than what it used to be, in short.
Jeremy Fowler, row crop farmer in Atwood, Tennessee. Give me some background on you, your operation, and then how you came into this and why you're talking to me about precision agriculture. I know that's a big question. Start at the beginning.
Third generation producer, raised corn, wheat, soybeans, and cattle, and cotton. And we've been CRP, some function of CRP, different levels of it and different aspects of it for 20 years or longer, probably. My granddaddy was before that, but my active role, probably 20 years, several different functions of it, from filter strips to wildlife plots to full farm CRPs to corner CRPs, with different, like the flexibility Jacob talked about. We're seeing a lot of benefits. Everybody's situation is different. You really have to look at your own farm by farm. And we've made some landowners happy and saved their farm in erosion control and built wildlife and helped the soil. We've had farms we put in 10 years ago, then we pulled them back out and went back into production, and they was twice as productive as they was when we put them in.
Yeah, so to the person that doesn't know anything about this, like I said, CRP, I think 86 was the very first year they rolled this out. And the idea was to take unproductive ground out and return it to nature. But they also know the government program was that there's a cost to this. So what you just said there, you've been farming yourself. You said third generation. So let's say you're about, what, 40 or so years old, let's say?
Yes, sir, 44.
All right. So you've... From the time you've been actively farming, this has been something that you've known about. And then you said you've taken some of your landlords and put them into this. So kind of tell me about that. You went to some of the people that you farm their ground and said, hey, you know what? I think you should take this ground and put it in CRP. And they said, well, wouldn't you rather grow cotton on it? And you said, no, I'd rather grow up in prairie grass. How'd that happen?
Well, we look at yield history all the time and data and yield maps off of our combines. And we can take those information and share them with our landlord and say, hey, look, your farm's just not producing what we need to produce. And with input costs the way they've been and rising, especially in the last year and years in the past, a lot of times I can guarantee them more money in CRP than I can give them in row crop production, because our farm's not producing what it needs to produce. And once you show those numbers and share those numbers with them and share the benefits with them, hey, this is going to make your farm better. There's some maintenance that goes along with it. We usually have a maintenance agreement that I take care of, and they pay me for that. So I'm still getting a little bit out of the farm, but they're getting what they need a lot of times more than I can pay them on a row crop production side. And we're doing everybody a favor.
Yeah, except that you lose the acres. Does that matter to you? There's a lot of farmers that don't want to give up acres. And you and I both probably, it sounds like based on what I'm hearing you say, there's acres you should give up, right?
Took me a while to learn that, but my philosophy is bad ground will break you and good ground will make you. And I look at my production history constantly every year, semi-annually, and say, hey, look, you know, what farms at the bottom tier, what farms at the top tier, what can we do to get these bottom tier farms with the top tier farms? If not, where else can we go with them? Can we put them in a CRP program? Can we do this? We need to talk to the landlord and lower the rent, you know. It's a numbers game. If you're not looking at the numbers, especially in today's economy and the agriculture world, you can get in trouble really quick.
Yeah, there's no question. So, Jeremy, my question to you then is, you said you've turned some landowners onto this, and then presumably some of your own farm ground. Precision conservation. You were doing this before Jacob came along, but tell me what your concept is here. You know, you're not talking about just taking a whole field and turn it into, you know, conservation ground. You're doing it based on, like you said, yield history, and you're taking the stuff that it would be better off reverting to nature, right?
Right. More times than not, we don't take the whole farm. We'll take part of the farm. We're in, we don't have big fields. You know, our average field size, big field size is probably 50 acres, you know. We have woods, we have fence rows, we have ditches, we're contoured, you know, we're building terraces and putting in drainage pipe all the time. around trees. You know, we always have troubles, always no productive areas. You got little corners in fields. Cut that corner off, make those rows straight, and put that corner in a wildlife plot with Quail Unlimited or CRP or something that will pay you more than you will ever get out of it production-wise. And that's kind of what we've seen and we've done a lot of. In certain instances, we've done whole farms. But we've done more of the small scale, hey, 5 acres on this farm, 10 acres on this farm. Also on blue line streams, you know, if you got a big creek running through your farm, we put in 30-foot filter strips, 15-foot filter strips. They pay in history really, really well. We've got some paying $200 an acre. We're saving our dirt, and we're not washing the creek away, you know?
Yeah. So you sound like the – again, there's a lot of farm people who would say, I'm not going to go and tell my landowner to put stuff in a CRP because I'm going to lose those acres. But you're saying, no, don't take the whole place. Let's take the 30 feet along the creek. Let's take this area over here, the tilly, curvy, erodible, whatever, whatever. And so does this enhance your relationship with the landowner? I got to assume that it does.
What I have found, more transparent and open you can be with the landowner, the better off you are, and they will listen. They want to listen. They want their farm better once you explain it to them. And that builds a relationship from now on. You know, that landowner may buy another farm somewhere and we'll meet a row crop. You know, you just, those relationships you build just by being open with them and trying to better their farm really builds a respect between you and them.
How many acres do you farm, Jeremy?
Farm about 3,000 acres.
And how many acres have you lost by telling folks to, put it into the CRP? A couple hundred?
Probably over the last 20 years, a couple hundred, 200 to 300.
Yeah. Which again, sounds like a lot, but it's probably enhanced your ability, like you said, to build a relationship with somebody that's a investor or a landowner. Then they're like, hey, this guy actually is taking care of the ground.
Correct. Correct. The first thing you got to get the landowner to understand is all farms are not the same. And that's the hardest battle I've had. Hey, your neighbor's farm's producing this and yours is producing this. They want to pin it back on you, which is not always the case. You have to get through their head. Hey, not, all dirt's not the same. I'm sorry. We're doing the same methods on everybody, you know, pretty much. But we need to look at some different options here.
All right. So the person agreed. Absolutely. All land is not created equal. There's a couple of farms within a couple miles of my place that I wouldn't give you a nickel for. And there's a couple that I'd actually like to have. So I understand exactly what you're saying. Good. Jacob, pheasants forever, quail forever. It's about wildlife habitat. And that's your job is to go out and create habitat. And right now you're in a up cycle. You know, corn, $6.70, soybeans, $15, whatever. Even wheat's now had a big rally. So, you know, Jeremy's down there making all this big money off of wheat. And then you're trying to tell them, hey, you know what? You don't need all those acres. And they're saying, screw you. I want every last acre I can because I'm making a bunch of money. It's a tough sell right now. Yes,
it is a tough sell. But one of the things and the beauty of this position and what we're doing with this program is that we understand that where there's not all dirt's created the same, there's not all farms need habitat. And so that's one of the things we're set out to do is use that data to find the areas, even in when we've got 13 and a half bushel dollars per bushel soybeans and $7 corn and even cotton doing really well right now. It's even when we have that, we want to find the acres that when we have those high prices or those low input costs, the acres that are still underproducing is what we want to target. And if we sit out and work out with a farmer and we look at 3,000-4,000 acres worth of data, and there's not a single acre on that farm that would be suitable to actually improve return on investment, we're not going to touch it. Even if we go and look at a farm, for example, and we see some red acres and we look at taking those out, what would it look like? What would the rest of the farm look like if we took these acres out? And if the return on investment only improves by 2-3%, it's not worth our time. Mm-hmm. We're looking at acres that are improving 20-30% return on investment on the rest of the farm. We don't want to touch anything because in the end, marginal acres, some marginal acres will be profitable and some marginal acres will remain marginal no matter what the economy does, no matter what the market does. And so that's our goal.
Got it. I want to hear more about the figuring out the numbers. Before we do that, I want to hear a message from our good friends at AgVisor Pro. Hey folks, you know that farmers spend 19% of their time seeking information? Did you hear what I said? One-fifth of a farmer's day is spent seeking information. The knowledge farmers need to stay ahead of the curve is out there, but that doesn't mean it's easy to find or fast to find. So what do? You go to AgVisor Pro. It's an app you download it on your phone. It was created by my good friend, Rob Syke. They're doing cool things. It's expertise at your fingertips. So the next great revolution in agriculture is finding the right information from the right expert at the right time. AgVisor Pro is jumpstarting that revolution. They've got an independent network of some of the best professionals in agriculture, and it's, again, all at your fingertips on an app on your phone. It's the future of information finding versus information seeking. Don't spend 19% of your time seeking information. Get the information you need immediately at AgVisor Pro. All right, so we're back now. Let's talk about the Red Acres and Green Acres. So you know what? Most farms wouldn't give you that information. Most farmers would say, who the hell is this guy from Pheasants Unlimited or Pheasants Forever? I keep saying Unlimited. It's Whitetails Unlimited and Ducks Unlimited. But anyway, it's Pheasants Forever. A guy like Jeremy, he's kind of reluctant to say, hey, here's my numbers. Here's this. But you dig in and say, no, let's face it. You know what? There's no way that those 4 acres over there in the corner that lay wet are actually returning investment to you. So give me how you go about that.
So yield is relative. So 150 bushel corn is going to be productive for someone. And
if we get 150 bushel, if we get, and no offense to my friend Jeremy, I'm not sure where Atwood, Tennessee is, but I'm here in Northeast Indiana. If we get 150 bushel corn on my field over here on the corner, I'm going to fire the operator. if we're doing 150 bushel corn, we got a problem, unless it's a drought year. Isn't that right, Jeremy?
Correct.
What is a normal yield in Atwood, Tennessee, where you are?
5-year APH of 181.
Okay, so you're probably similar to where we are here, but yeah. So go ahead, Jacob. I interrupt you. I had to talk some farmer talk there. You know what? Coffee shop talk. We like talking about yields.
That's fine. Well, no, basically yield is relative, and so one of the things that we set out to do is to turn that yield into profit. And so sit down and let's look at if a farmer. You had said most farmers might be reluctant. And so where we start is building relationships and start with outreach contacts. And then over time, if the farmer, maybe he's harvested through the field, he's like, yeah, I know I'm losing money on this tree line. I want to know how much. Is it worth my time? And if we build that relationship, if we look at one field worth of data, then maybe down the road, we end up looking at the whole operation. But what we want to end up doing is looking at that yield data and making it profit, make these yield maps turn into profit maps, and then look at several years worth of this data. So really what we're doing is sitting down with crop budgets, whether it's the state average, if the farmer doesn't really have the time to dig into exactly how much he spent, or he does, he has it all organized and sitting out in front of him, then we'll take that yield, we'll take the price that he sold it at, and then we'll subtract the cost from it, whether it be just volatile costs or fixed costs or both of them. And then look at that over 5 or 6 years. And then that way we have a better sample size. And when we make a decision, we're making an informed decision. I spend a lot of my time just doing scenarios. If we took this out and then let's look at the soil type and I can kind of estimate what CRP would bring. And then I take that to the farmer. And if it's on rented ground, I take it to the farmer. And then I take it to the landowner.
So you just mentioned a thing like, okay, along a tree line. If you're kind of where Jeremy is, or even, you know, some of my ground out here, certainly the same situation. We know that you're losing stuff within 30 foot of the tree line. So put it into a buffer strip. All this works with CRP. In other words, you can't convince people to go and do this unless there's a CRP payment. Am I right, Jacob?
Well, we have a lot of different programs, and especially on rented ground. And if you're really looking at improving your return on investment, the most CRP is the best option. But in a scenario where someone doesn't want to tie up some ground for 10 to 15 years, there's another program we call the Environmental Qualities Incentive Program. And that program is what we call the Fix-It Program. It's a one-time cost share payment, and it can be wildlife-based. And essentially, we'll go in and in RCS, USDA, they will cost share for the seeding, for the site prep, and then leave it. So let's say we want to take this buffer strip out for 5 years and we do an equip contract and we own this ground and we get cost share to put it in. Let's say we get 100% cost share. It depends because in RCS offers, or they use a set rate based off the state average to cost your seed and stuff like that. And so you might get anywhere from 75 to 100%, just depends on your state. But if we cost share that in and then you don't touch it for 5 years, and if you own that ground, you're saving money by not planting, spraying, and harvesting those 5 acres along the tree line.
Yeah. So, by the way, all this stuff works in conjunction with the USDA. There's no Pheasants Forever doesn't give me money. It's you coordinate it, but I get my money from the United States Department of Agriculture, right?
We have a lot of different partnerships, and really there's the federal programs are really the best ones that we're able to operate off of. But in different states, we have partnerships and different program opportunities that are really diversified and unique based on your region. And in my area, we really don't have that here. That's because Quail Forever in our region down here in the Mid-South, we're not as developed and haven't been here as long as people in Pheasants Forever up in the Midwest. So they have a lot more relationships and partnerships they've built up that way. But there are state, local program opportunities. You just have to reach out to your local Pheasants Quail Forever representative to kind of get some more information on that.
Jeremy, give me some results. All right. You already talked about going to some landowners and saying, hey, you know what? This 8 acres over here is it's scrubby. It's hilly. It's eroded. Your best bet is to put it in CRP. So give me some. You've had a success going into your landlords and converting some stuff. You've done some of this on your own owned acres. True.
Correct.
What are you putting these acres into up here? I've mentioned prairie grass and tree plantings. That's what I've put down on my CRP. What are you putting in Tennessee?
We've done, of course, it's all about money. Of course, always how much money you're going to get from USDA or Quail Forever. Different programs change all the time. Typical government, but we've got some pollinators, you know, which is bee program stuff. That's played really good here lately. We've got
some. And by the way, so the person listening to this is going to say pollinators. I've read the program, but for those that have not, what that means is it's a mix of stuff you're seeding, correct?
Correct. It's all kind of different wildflowers and stuff for bees and bugs. And it's beautiful when it comes up and it's growing. I mean, it looks, I have people take pictures of mine a lot. Come out to the farm from the city and, hey, can we take a picture in your fields? Yeah, sure. But it's good for, it's a win-win for everybody. And then we put some in wildlife stuff, different wildlife mixes. And like I said, it all goes back to the program and the year. It changes constantly. And that's where Jacob comes in a lot, helping me as he's come on. It's hard for me to keep up with the programs and what's changing, but you have to be in constant contact with USDA and your NRCS and Quail Forever people and just all the entities involved to see what's best for you and the landowner. Just because it worked this year, it may not work next year. So we have several different factors. We've sold just plain grass before, you know, just fescue and orchard grass on streams and stuff, buffer strips and stuff. That's worked really well for us. You know, it holds the ground. That's our main objective, is trying to hold the ground from erosion. So
right.
There's several different, but on the aspect of an example, say I put some corners of a field, 50 acre field, had some odd corners set up in some woods, took it out 5 years ago, put it in some kind of CRP program, go back and show the landowner 5 years later, hey, here's how much the yields have improved overall on your farm. You know, that 50 acres, we had a yield of 142 corn. Now we've got a yield of 162 corn because we took the non-productive acres out. Mm-hmm. And yeah, you're still getting paid for those acres. You're getting more out of them acres than you would ever get out of me farming them, you know, me producing.
So answer me this, and let's be honest here. You know, I've mentioned the history of CRP, Conservation Reserve Program that came in 86. These programs, I mean, having Jacob come out and Quail Forever and all that, it doesn't work without the CRP program. I mean, your landowner, landlords aren't going to do this for free. No. Are they, Jeremy?
No, not very, very seldom. Most of them, it all boils down to yield and money, like we've already spoken about. But if you can't show them where they can get a return on investment, they're not interested.
Right. By the way, can I ask you this question? Mr. Fowler, you're a third generation farmer down there. A guy comes out for Pheasants Forever and like Jacob and calls on you and you say, son, There's no pheasants in Tennessee except for in zoos. What the hell are you talking about, pheasants? There's no pheasants in Tennessee. Am I right?
Right. Correct.
There's just quail, right? So when he talks about improving habitat, he said, you can create all the habitat you want. We're still not. You have to drive up to South Dakota and catch them and haul them down here before we have pheasants in Tennessee. So anyway, it's all about the quail for you guys, right?
It's all about quail. And we've seen the results out of that. I'm a hunter. I have hunters. I have landlords that's hunters. Our quail population is, like a lot of the rest of the country, has demised in the last 20 years. It's hard to go find a covey of quail a lot of times, but we've seen the benefits of adding a lot of this stuff in habitat for them, and it's benefiting us on the other side too. So I think it's a win-win for all situations.
Yeah, so you actually are seeing from the combine and from the tractor seat, and then also when you have a gun in hand with a dog, you are seeing an increase in the population?
Correct.
Do you make money off of charging people to go hunting on your property, Jeremy?
No, sir. I have in the past. I had a small youth hunting business in the past, but we shut it down, and I still do a lot of hunting and carry a lot of kids hunting, our specialties kids. I've got two teenage kids. It's myself that's helping me with that now, but we kind of cater to underprivileged, handicapped kids and give them an opportunity that they might not get otherwise.
Got it. All right. So what do I need to know, Jacob? You reached out to me, you listened to my podcast, and you want to tell them about this. And I think it's cool about the precision. And I think it's a good labeling. And it's not bullshit marketing. It's real precision conservation, meaning we're prescribing it on bad acres. I mean, that's really what you're talking about. That's the whole concept of precision conservation. Yeah,
exactly right. Exactly right. Because there's so much data out there now with our late model combines and other, all of our late model equipment. Every 1 second in the field, we're collecting data. And that data ranges from yield to speed to, you know, equipment variables. So many different factors come from this yield data. And I'd say some people might argue against me or for it. 70% of or more is not used. And we're just trying to give it another use. Because now that all of this technology becomes standard on equipment, you're paying for it. You are. So let's put it to use. And yield data is not the only sort of data we can use. There's other data like NDVI, soil maps. And NDVI is essentially all it is measuring the greenness or the health of the plant through the growing season. We can use that as a proxy to estimate yield or back up yield. So there's all kinds of different data, whether it's open source or whether it's what you collect in the field, and let's put it to use.
You talked about being able to take turn rows, which that's a Southern term. We call them end rows up here, but turn rows. And so, you know, a guy like Jeremy, he's got big equipment. So what, 40 feet probably at the end of a field. You're putting that into a CRP program. He's still allowed to drive over it at doing his spraying and his planting, et cetera. So he doesn't get any trouble for that, because there's rules about, you know, anybody I talk to is like, hey, I want to be careful. I put this in some CRP, then the government's going to be here making me do this, this, and this. Talk to me about that.
There's a new practice in CRP that came out, I think, 4 or 5 years ago. And it's called prairie strips, and it's gained some traction. And we just now started using it down here. And those prairie strips are essentially just like a field border, except it's going to be a little bit more grass heavy. It's going to have a couple more wildflowers, and it's supposed to be placed on the ground to where it addresses soil and water resource concerns. So where we know there's a potential to wash, or we've got some washing, or we've got some water traveling across that ground, and it can be run through the middle of the field. It can be run at the edge of the field. It can almost be put anywhere, prescribed anywhere in the farm. And in the language of CRP, it says that you can use it as turn row. During normal operations. Now, maybe not, you're not driving through it every week. You got your crop scout going through there on a four-wheeler marking up the dirt trails, but you're turning around on it with our equipment, with a planter tractor, with a combine, whatever it might be.
Okay. Jeremy, have you done any of that on end rows, turn rows?
I have not.
And I can see where it would make sense. There's places where, you know, your end rows or turn rows are yielding half of what the rest of the field is, because you drive over them with a sprayer three times, you know, they get the hell beat out of them, right?
Correct.
Do you see yourself doing those in the future?
Yes, we've already been in negotiations and looking at some of that very thing. on what we call end rows or turn rows, not so much in the middle of the field. What we run into in the middle of the field is keeping that established for long term. We've played with that in the past, and with the big sprayers and equipment we have nowadays, it's hard to keep Joe Blow out of it with a plow or a sprayer, you know, for 5 years straight. It winds up getting banged up, and, you know, it's hard to keep established. But on the end rows, yes, I think it's doable. I think it's a great idea. Like you said, we're banging it up, running over it. You made a valid point there.
What about cover crops? You know, I think there's going to be a push for cover crops. And I mean, I don't know, this whole climate bill that just got pushed through, it's going to throw $20 billion in agriculture. I've read through it. I don't know that it's going to incentivize cover crops. I believe that cover crops are the way of the future. You're in a more climatologically friendly area for cover crops. Up here, they'll say, well, it's hard to get them established if your corn comes off late, whatever. But putting cover out there is good for wildlife, not even just quail and pheasant, but everything. Is there a future where groups like conservation groups like Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever, and then USDA, and then operators like you, Jeremy, where we say, let's make this make sense because cover crops are good? And is that a future where more acres have cover crops that's good for the farmer, good for the ground, and good for the wildlife?
I think you hit all three of the nail on the head. We've been moving from 300 to 500 acres every year. We'll put in about 600 acres this fall. We're seeing benefit in all three categories. You know, it's building our ground, it's holding our wildlife. It's a homemade food plot. That's what we call it. You know, we're deer hunting over it, and you know, and then we're getting paid to do it. Also, it's a win-win. The only hiccup that we're seeing, and we're trying to figure it out as we go every year, but planting conditions in spring can be a little tough. You know, that's a year by year deal. And that's something that we're trying to weed through, whether you're planting corn or beans back in it.
You put cover crop in the fall, let's say, when you know, after the combine runs through, you're saying that then if spring is late or wet or whatever, terminating the cover crop?
Yeah. Well, after you terminate it, it creates a biomass, basically, or organic matter, you know, it's the mat on the ground a lot of times, and that is tough to get. We're about 95% no-till, you know, and that's because we're conservation, trying to keep our dirt where it's at, and it's hard to plant through sometimes. We've had to get creative with planters and timing of when we terminated it and all that, but it can be an issue. That's the biggest hill we've climbed so far, and that's what we see every year, and you don't know what the spring's going to be like. But I think it's a win-win. I've had farms 5 years in a row in it already. I'm seeing not huge benefits, but little gains at a time. You're not going to see a big benefit 1 year. Put it in there 5 years and try it then. On farms where we're not growing wheat is where we're using it, because, you know, wheat's a fall crop.
Yeah.
We're using it where we're not growing wheat in those farms, and it is – my yields are – I can prove it's working.
You can prove that cover crops are giving you a benefit after 5 years because of yield gain. And that's because it held moisture. It's because it enhanced the soil biology, those kinds of things.
Correct. Both.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that we're going to look back someday, and you're a little younger than me, but I think we're going to look back someday. And I wrote about it in my book, at all the excessive tillage, particularly fall tillage. And we're going to look at it the way they look at using leeches for medical care. Like, what the hell are they thinking? That's my prediction.
Right. Correct. I think you're spot on.
Sounds like you and I get along. So the only thing that we got to figure out is can we drink Coors Banquet, and B, that's after I come down there and shoot quail on your farms. Is that what I'm talking about?
Well, I'll go Coors Lightweed. How about that? And yeah, you can come hunting. What part of Indiana are you in?
Northeastern Indiana. I'm in Huntington, which is about 60 miles, 70 miles south of the Michigan line, about 50 miles west of the Ohio line.
Okay. I've got some history in a place called Huntingburg, Indiana. Down around Owensboro, Kentucky.
Right. But, that's southern Indiana.
I was spending a little bit of time hunting there, and the guy I hunt with is tied up with quail forever there and has done a lot of good work up there. So anyway, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, that's cool. Jacob, take me out here. Precision ag, precision conservation. Like I said, it's a new term. It's a good term. Like I said, from just a standpoint of what you're attempting to explain to people now. You know, it wasn't that long ago that they'd say, I'm not going to put my stuff in CRP. You're going to come out here and mess up my stuff. And for, you know, 15 years or whatever, to the person that says, well, I'm willing to do this, but I don't want to have it be forever. You know, we got quail forever, but I don't want my ground to be in CRP forever because I'm not sure what's coming along. How do you address that? Again, you can't plant trees because that's kind of forever, right? So you tell them, no, it could be just a 10-year thing, and then we'll wait and see.
Right. So with quail and pheasant, those two birds, they need the habitat they need is something that's not going to get higher than your chest, and it's nothing that's going to be grown up in trees. So we're going to help and prescribe and recommend to these landowners and farmers exactly how to manage this to keep our trees out. We have a tree problem down here. And so everything wants to grow up in trees, but we're doing everything we can to keep trees out of it because the quail and pheasants do not benefit from trees. And then down the road, when we want to farm some of these acres again, like if we've got a ridge or something that needs to be built, the soil needs to be built up again on it, it's thin, and we put this in CRP, well, we need to be able to farm in 10 years or 20 years like Jeremy was talking about. So we're going to recommend and set up a plan to where you can manage this to where it'll be farmable again in 10 years.
Yeah. I imagine much of your management, a guy like Jeremy goes out there sometime after August, after the nesting season, and then mows it. You do some burning probably as well? You burn for management?
No, I do not. We've done all different scenarios through the years. But right now, currently, we're mowing half of the farm every other year on about all our CRP, and that's keeping our trees out. Like, we're mowing strips. We'll go in there and mow strips, and that's good for our hunting, and it holds the wildlife there. But, you know, we're actually doing that today. And that keeps our trees out. Plus, you know, we're holding our wildlife there with some cover, you know, that's waist high. And that's kind of how we're managing 95% of no burning.
Got it. So last on the way out of here, recommendation, somebody that's listening to this that says, you know what, maybe I should do this, maybe I shouldn't do this, learning curve, recommendation, lessons, things you did wrong, both of you. What do you got for me? Go ahead, Jacob.
Sit down, look at your operation. Look at every farm. Look at those spots that's not productive. Get involved with your local USDA, NRCS guys. See what's out there. You know, it changes all the time. And be in contact. Have conversations with your landlord. Don't be scared to go talk to them. That's one thing that I've overcome in the last 10 years. Be transparent with your landlords. That's what they want.
Yeah, I like that. And like you said, the reality is you might give up some acres, but some of those acres you're giving up,
you're not making any money on those acres. If you'll sit down and look at it and be real about it, use real numbers, you're better off without them.
Yeah. There's probably 5 or 10% of the acres that you're farming that are actually losing, probably, right?
Correct.
I mean, unless you're in Champaign, Illinois, then there's no way.
Yeah.
All right. Jacob, close me out here.
This fall, we're harvesting right now. So we're on the combines. When you're going through the in rows, going through different areas of the field, pay attention to that yield monitor. Just take a look at it and think about it while you're on the combine. And down the road, we can look at some maps and let's just see, you know, what one field is doing and see if that scenario is worth it for you. And we can try, we can experiment just like we experiment with cover crops on a farm or two. Like we can experiment with this on a farm or two.
Yeah. And the other thing is, since most of your stuff is recommending and then you're the technical advisor and then you tie it back to a U.S. Department of Agriculture program, the person that's listening is going to say, yeah, but I thought that those were only sign up for so much. What you're telling me is most of these are available all the time, right? The programs.
Partial field stuff like borders. We've got a couple other customizable programs. They're continuous sign up. And so especially on sensitive ground, which is what we're targeting, it's a continuous sign up. And then you roll right in as long as you meet eligibility requirements.
Yeah. So they don't have to wait until it's announced 3 years from now, new farm bill or none of that. It could be available like tomorrow.
On most ground in most situations, the answer is yes.
Got it. So if they want to learn more about this, where do they go?
You can go to our website, pheasantsforever.org, quailforever.org. You can go to us on Facebook. We have a Tennessee Quail Forever Facebook. You can visit us there. There's a lot of – just type in Quail Forever on the internet.
Got it. And if you want to hear from a real farmer who is also a sportsman and a conservation-minded guy, you can reach out to Jeremy Fowler. Jeremy, they can find you through me, but maybe do you have a farm website?
No, I do not.
Okay. Sorry. So can we find you? Can we find you, or do they just got to reach me to reach you?
Probably just reach you to reach me.
Got it. All right. So my name's Damian Mason. His name's Jeremy Fowler. He's an Atwood, Tennessee farmer, and he's an advocate for what we're talking about, which is precision conservation. Jacob Taylor is with Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever. And you already heard you can go to quailforever.org or pheasantsforever.org to learn more about that. Till next time, thanks for being here, guys.
Thank you.
You bet. Till next
time,
this is the Agriculture. Well, that concludes another fantastic episode of The Business of Agriculture. This episode was brought to you by Pattern Ag. You know, everybody in agriculture understands the importance of soil health. We also keep an eye on our soil better than we ever did through advanced soil testing. But what if there was a company that provided predictive analytics? Not just checking out nutrients and all the elements that are in there, but also could tell you the degree of risk you face with disease and pest pressure. That's right. Pattern Ag can do that. They actually can tell you, hey, you're going to have a real issue here. You can preemptively, proactively treat for corn rootworm or cyst nematode or sudden death syndrome before the problem actually starts costing you yield. Go to pattern.ag. That's www.pattern.ag to find the nearest rep that can help you start doing better for your soil.